The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that states are constitutionally barred from executing the retarded. That was just one of several decisions by the High Court yesterday. Among others, a ruling that made it easier for patients to challenge decisions by health maintenance organizations, and a ruling on student privacy. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Not many Supreme Court decisions are truly landmarks, but the Supreme Court's 6-3 decision yesterday declaring the death penalty for the retarded to be unconstitutionally cruel and unusual punishment certainly falls into that category. In many ways, the court's decision was 13 years in the making. In 1989, the justices upheld the death penalty for the retarded on the grounds that there was no national consensus against it. But writing for the 6-member court majority yesterday, Justice John Paul Stevens said a lot had changed in those 13 years. In 1989, there were only 2 state laws barring capital punishment for the retarded. Now there are 18, and combined with the 12 states that have no death penalty at all, that means a majority of the states do not execute the retarded. Thus, it's fair to say, the court concluded, that there is now a national consensus against capital punishment for the retarded. Certainly, mentally retarded individuals should be punished for their crimes, the court said, but because they typically have the mental age of a 9 to 12-year-old, they are in fact less culpable than other adults, even though they do know right from wrong. The decision was praised by human rights organizations, the American Bar Association, and even by some prosecutors. But district attorneys predicted an avalanche of claims from death row inmates asserting they're retarded. Virginia prosecutor Eileen Addison said she expects the number of retardation claims to grow.
Astronomically, I can virtually guarantee you that every person in this state, in this country, that's charged with capital murder and facing a possible death penalty will have a claim of mental retardation.
Addison was the prosecutor in the case ruled on by the Supreme Court yesterday. Justice Stevens, in his opinion for the court, acknowledged there is little doubt about the defendant Darrell Atkins' guilt. He kidnapped and murdered a 21-year-old airman whose only crime was to be outside a convenience store at the wrong moment. There is also no doubt Atkins had a long history of other violent crimes. The question was whether he was, in essence, too mentally disabled to be held to the highest standard of responsibility and executed. Prosecutor Addison thinks the Supreme Court's decision will make no difference, that Atkins in the end will still be eligible for the death penalty when the ruling is applied to his specific case by the Virginia courts. She contends he isn't really retarded. But the Supreme Court's opinion yesterday could make it difficult to sustain that argument. The court adopted the definition of retarded put forth by the American Association of Retardation, an IQ of under 70, a demonstrated inability to perform the basic functions of life unassisted, and a record of limited mental capacity that predates the defendant's 18th birthday. Darrell Atkins was tested with an IQ of 59. He had a long history of failure in school, and there was testimony that he could not do such basic chores as shop for groceries on his own. Some prosecutors, and Justice Antonin Scalia in his dissenting opinion, have suggested that defendants may fake being retarded to avoid the death penalty.
I think that's ridiculous.
Beth Wilkinson was one of the prosecutors who asked for the death penalty in the Oklahoma City bombing case against Timothy McVeigh.
I don't think it will be a real problem.
Stephen Bright, who handles death cases for the Southern Center for Human Rights, says that in the states that have barred the death penalty for the retarded, such claims are usually and quite easily settled before trial.
My experience has been that very often these cases are resolved between the prosecution and the defense, because in cases of people who are mentally retarded, there's usually a pretty long and well-documented history. The people have been in special education. They have been seen as intellectually limited by people all the way through their lives. So there's not the kind of issue you have often with mental illness where there's a real debate about is this person mentally ill or is there not. Of course, the close cases are the ones that go to trial.
Robert McCullough, a Missouri district attorney, agrees, but only up to a point.
There hasn't been a huge dispute, but I think that's going to change.
The president of the National Association of Attorneys General, Oklahoma's Drew Edmondson, says that there are a lot of kinks to be ironed out yet in the system.
It's going to be up to, I assume, lower federal courts to hammer out the objective criteria to determine whether a person is ineligible for the death penalty under Atkins versus Virginia.
Dissenting from yesterday's ruling were Justices Scalia and Thomas and Chief Justice Rehnquist. In a rare oral dissent from the bench, Scalia denounced the court majority for overriding legislative judgments with a, quote, raw and arrogant exercise of judicial power. Surely, said Scalia, culpability depends not merely upon the mental capacity of the criminal, as long as he knows right from wrong, but also upon the depravity of the crime. In a second important decision yesterday, this one involving health care, the Supreme Court upheld an Illinois law that requires HMOs upon demand to pay for and abide by an independent review of any decision denying care as medically unnecessary. The case was brought by Deborah Moran, an Illinois speech therapist with a rare and damaging nerve problem in her arm, a condition so severe she couldn't lift a fork to eat. When physical therapy and surgery didn't work, her HMO doctor recommended a rare surgical procedure only done out of state. But the HMO, Rush Prudential, refused to pay the $95,000 cost of the operation, even after an independent reviewer at Johns Hopkins concluded it was medically necessary. The HMO asserted that a federal law covering employee benefits did not have an independent review provision, and that the federal law trumped the state law. But yesterday, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, ruled that the independent review procedure in Illinois is exactly what Congress did not intend to preempt, namely the ordinary state regulation of insurance. Some 39 other states have laws like Illinois', so the ruling was a blow to HMOs. Attorney Mark Dubofsky specializes in health law.
It tilts the playing field a little bit more toward the consumer, or at least makes it more even, that the consumer can feel confident that the insurance company isn't going to be making these medical necessity decisions through doctors who are on their staff or totally captive of the different HMOs.
Professor Mark Drenning, an editor of a number of health law publications, sees yesterday's ruling as a significant victory for some 70 million HMO patients across the country.
It's certainly going to make it clear that when a person does ask for an independent physician review, their HMO cannot say no to that kind of request.
In another decision yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that the statistical method that the Census Bureau uses to fill in gaps in population counts is permissible both under federal law and under the Constitution's requirement for an actual enumeration of the population. The court's 5-4 ruling means that North Carolina gets to keep the new seat it got under the 2000 census at the expense of Utah, which lost a seat. And finally, yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal law protecting the privacy of student records cannot be enforced with private lawsuits. The case stemmed from a lawsuit brought by a student at Gonzaga University who won a defamation suit against university officials for telling state officials about date rape charges against him, charges that the student was never told about and that the alleged victim denied. In addition to damages won for defamation, the student won damages for Gonzaga's violation of the federal law that protects the privacy of student records. But the Supreme Court, by a vote of 7-2, ruled that the law did not specifically authorize such private suits, and the court said that such suits are not permissible unless they are unambiguously authorized by Congress. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.